Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. As we head into Hour 3, it's a delight to have Hugh Holman and Lewis Holman in studio. Lewis Holman is the Managing Director of Insight Analytics, LLC, I-N-C-I-T-E, Analytics, LLC. Hugh Holman, former mayor of Tempe, attorney, educator, many other things. Great dancer. You got a great rug Saturday at a gala that you were generous enough to invite me to, where you performed wonderfully. For a great cause. You want to put in a word for the organization real quick?
Certainly. The organization is the Arizona Autism Charter Schools, and they have created a charter envelope to educate kids who have various neurospectrum disorders, and that includes autism, and that was their primary feature. The fundraiser we attended, thank you for attending, was to raise money to support their efforts. It's an incredible organization. But you misstated, I have a great rug. This is real hair. I do not have a great rug. I cut a good rug on Saturday. That would be dancing. Having a good rug is having a good toupee. Let's keep those things different, because I spend a lot of time convincing people that this is not a toupee. Now, I do have a variety of models of them. They are on different heads that I keep in my bedroom, so that way I can have the disheveled one, the one that looks like I've just been running, et cetera. But
oh, it was beautiful.
I like
though.
The Carmen Miranda one personally.
Hey, there you go,
Carmen Miranda. It was beautiful. What did Bob Hope say about Lucille Ball? The only woman I know who gets her hair colored at Earl Scheib.
Yes.
There was not a dry eye in the room after the first opening performance.
Yes,
it was a beautiful performance.
The school's dance team.
Dancing.
The reason for all of this was it was a Dancing for the Stars gig. In order to emphasize the fact that the school uses dance as one of its athletic activities for physical education, and it's a particularly good thing to use with kids with autism.
Yeah.
It provides focus, activity, but also using music. Music tends to touch us deeply for reasons we don't understand, and that's true even with kids with autism.
It's the kind of education I would support wholeheartedly. What we're going to have now is a conversation about the kinds of education we should start thinking about not supporting, perhaps even defunding. I noticed a press conference with the Speaker of the House of Representatives, Mike Johnson, earlier today, where he was unveiling a whole series of hearings and investigations into what is going on at these university campuses, and having to do with funding, having to do with justice, having to do with Title VI. And it dawned on me that this, in a better day and age, is something that really should be under the Department of Justice and the administration, if they would do something about enforcement of Title VI, but they won't. Miguel Cardona, the Secretary of Education, was asked if he has any of his staff at the Department of Education at any of these universities, including investigating civil rights violations under Title VI. He said he does not. This is the job for the administration. I'm glad to see Mike Johnson standing up for it, but I'm glad someone is, but it really is an administrative duty. Sorry.
No, well, it is the use of the investigative power that the Department of Justice has to enforce the laws. That is the definition of what the administration is supposed to do. It is supposed to be enforcing the laws. And here you have a series of laws that would assist universities that are currently under siege with administrators who have long lost the ability to act as honest brokers. And because they gave up their status as honest brokers on free speech and academic freedom, and clearly used it differently depending on the speech that was being made, the content, the substance, they no longer have any credibility. And as a result of having lost that credibility, now when they need it against their own side, where children have gone off to the complete extremes on the left, uneducated, thoughtful youth shouting slogans that they do not understand, like, or most of them don't, from the river to the sea, which is, let's push every Jew out of Israel because we want Palestine to be free, and that's in quotations, and I'm going to call on Lewis to provide a little bit of background on our use of the word Palestinians. Why don't we do that right this moment, Lou?
Certainly. So the notion of Palestine, Palestine was not ever a nation state in the traditional sense. The area that we're talking about as Palestine was controlled by the Ottoman Empire from about the middle of the 17th century onward, prior to that by the Egyptian Mamluks. And it only became the mandate of Palestine as a British colonial project. Indeed, these people that are very, very upset about the legacies of colonialism are very eager to reestablish a state based upon a colonial mandate that only existed for, I believe, a total of 28 years.
So the British colonial mandate that created the notion of Palestine is what these kids want now to reestablish and remove people whose ancestors date back 4,000 years or so.
And was the transitional administration between the area that had then been there after the collapse of the Ottoman Empire at the end of the First World War up through the Second World War and then up until the founding of the modern state of Israel?
Well, isn't there this thing called the Wailing Wall? And, you know, it's really, really low to the ground compared to the stuff that's on the top.
Well, we could talk a little bit about
built later, but I digress. I'm a little
tongue in cheek.
No,
it's a valid point.
There's actually, I think it is majorly relevant to talk about what the root of the issue is, historically speaking, because in Israel we have archaeological and anthropological evidence, as well as, of course, scripture indicating presence of Semitic peoples like the Jews in that region for thousands of years. And the Muslim claim to that region comes from what is in English known as the Dome of the Rock Mosque, I believe is the translation, right. Which is where Muhammad is in the religion of Islam is reported to have ascended to heaven at the end of his life in
creating Islam.
Creating Islam, and that would have occurred then somewhere in the 8th century AD.
Right.
And so we've got a gap here of several thousand years. So there is a legacy of settlement and a religious prescription to protect this place. The whole notion of pushing the Jews to the sea comes from a desire to keep this holy place of Islam sacred in much the same way that Mecca and Medina are kept sacred, in that you cannot, as a non-Muslim, actually physically enter the city of Mecca. It is illegal. You cannot do that. And so the desire is not for any sort of Western-style equality as we would understand and recognize it. It is for an ethnic and religious monoculture that is desired to be imposed in the name of this post-colonial mandate.
And, of course, that is why we joke about the silliness of LGBTQ for Palestine. It is rather like chickens for KFC and other similar sort of calls for that you would not see anyone who is gay entering Mecca.
No, I was making the point yesterday. You see a lot of people marching with signs LGBTQ for Palestine and Palestinians. You will never see Palestinians saying Palestine for LGBTQ.
Correct. Or Jews, for that matter. And that's why when Israel turned Gaza over to Hamas and the Palestinians, they removed, not only was every Jew living who moved out, but every Jew who had been buried there was also dug up and moved out. That's literally what they turned everything over to the Palestinians and Hamas under the British mandate term that we're now using, because that's, of course, what's mandated by the Colombian students, that is, students from Columbia, the university, not from the country. In any event, it's too easy to start being jocular about this because it is that absurd. When you see what's going on at these universities, it's head scratching, and it's not just the students. I watched last night several interviews with professors from Columbia and New York University, and it is head scratching. These people who have spent their entire lives in ivory towers with no connection to real life, no understanding what average men and women go through to build their lives and their families and support their lives and families, as their universities are gobbling up billions of dollars so that these folks can sit around and rub sand into their belly button and think about how important it is what they're thinking. And when we come back, I think I want to talk about how did we get here, not just as a university system, how we got our educational system this screwed up, but how it is that we have students this easily gathering to have these kinds of protests at an extended period of time.
As we go to break, let me add one more point. There are so many we could add to everything Lewis unfolded for us. Thank you for that, Lewis. Two points as we go to break. One is the marchers against colonialism. I think outside of Egypt, there's probably not a less colonialist state than Israel, given the definition of what colonialism is, in the entirety of the Middle East. That's point one. Point two is, isn't it interesting, especially knowing your history from the World War I mandate forward, Lewis, that no one ever marches for a Palestinian state in Jordan, which constitutes 70% of Palestinian Arab culture and was created out of that exact same territory after the 1922 mandate, right?
Well,
kind of interesting.
It would deny anti-Zionists the ability to bludgeon Jews.
That would be the problem. You would be protesting Arabs, not Jews. Exactly right. Lewis Hallman and Hugh Hallman and I will be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. The question of Palestine that Lewis Hallman and Hugh Hallman are doing with us here today. Just to fill out this point, maybe I didn't mean to go by it too quickly, but Jordan was created out of this whole cloth as well by Great Britain after World War I. And it was originally called Transjordan because mm-hmm. of the river. And it's the same exact people, same exact culture. But it was handed over to what were known as the Hashemites, which was really a Saudi Arabian. Talk about colonial. It was really a Saudi Arabian family that took over Jordan, the Abdullahs, King Abdullah, then his son, and then now his son, who is the king. It is interesting. You actually have a king whose family lineage is Saudi Arabian governing over a population that is 70%, by their own definition, Palestinian. And yet Israel's the colonialist and imperialist power.
Well, so much of this, I think, is, you know, not actually about Israel's crimes per se. And a lot of it functionally is about the excuse to bludgeon Israel and to exercise a lot of the freewheeling anti-Semitism on the left. There are many of those that think that anti-Semitism is the exclusive purview of the right. And to those that think that, I would encourage them to look up Karl Marx's 19th century work on the Jewish question, as that is an illuminating basis for much of the left's anti-Semitic tendencies. Now, as to the Columbia protest,
it was brought to a fine point by the Soviet Union,
yes,
following that philosophy, which gave rise to a special law that the United States passed in the early 1970s to put pressure on the Soviet Union to allow Jews to emigrate.
Jackson
that still
Vanek,
exists.
Right?
Jackson Vanek, exactly right.
But With the Columbia protests, there's really a remarkable series of things happening with those. The first thing that I'd like to point to is that we have largely the children of the wealthiest people in this country screaming and braying about equity and demanding that other people liquidate the Columbia endowment so that large amounts of its assets can be repositioned in a way that then doesn't give exposure to or prop up or contribute profit towards any Israeli organizations. I can't think of a move that is less physically impactful for the people on the ground than rejiggering the composition of Columbia's stock portfolio, which is fascinating. So ultimately, right, it's all symbolism. There's no actual care or thought or credence towards helping anyone, right? This is all a me symbolism game. That's the first thing. The second thing that's amazing about this is that these unbelievably privileged, unbelievably wealthy people, rather than sacrificing anything of their own comfort, are demanding that other people make sacrifices. I would like to see that Columbia, if it is to liquidate a portion of its portfolio, if it is to bend to these protests, then what it should do is it should liquidate a large proportion of its scholarship funding and use that to cover the transactions costs. Mm-hmm. If the students are so adamant that Columbia divest itself, then they should be the ones to foot the bill.
Sure.
Very easily.
And how did we get here? Why do we have all these students who come from very wealthy families who aren't clearly aren't studying in anticipation of their finals coming up, protesting? Now they've taken over a building in Columbia yesterday.
Remember when illegally taking over a building by violence was a threat to democracy?
It was indeed. In fact, especially, but only if you're a Republican.
Gotcha.
And only if you're not violent. If you break windows and otherwise threaten people with their lives, it's peaceful, mostly peaceful.
While calling for genocide?
Exactly right. But what I find as an example of how crazy this is, these are people who are now taking these brave actions, all of them wearing hoodies and masks to hide their identities. And as the university starts to threaten them with expulsion and suspensions, they all want amnesty. Now, wait a minute. I thought you cared about this cause. This was so important to you. You were putting yourself at risk. But know what you're now telling us is that it is a game. It is a performative. It is truly a performance to demonstrate your virtue signaling as you are now hanging out on the quad, sleeping in, and have your university professors coming to your aid because they don't think you should be punished and suffer the consequences of the acts you are taking. In contrast, somebody like Martin Luther King said that if we do this, you understand, we protest peaceably. Civil disobedience starts with the word civil. You are then complaining about an unjust law and recognize you should and will suffer the consequences under the rule of law for performing in a way that objects to it. That's the point. And yet now we have these privileged children who, after engaging in this performance, are now screaming and whining that they want amnesty for their bravery, while having engaged in it most of the time with masks and hoodies. And how did we get here? It is my youngest son I have to credit with this insight. This is the anti-bowling alone era. We had bowling alone because people, we had atomized our society and people didn't have a way to get together and be part of the de Tocqueville gathering. Well, now we have these devices, my son Marcus would say. Why are we calling it a phone? The least useful element of this rectangle, as he said, the rectangle, is the phone. The more important device on it, he thinks, is the flashlight. So we ought to just call it a flashlight. In addition, if the phone portion didn't work, most of us wouldn't care because what we use it for is texting most of the time, taking pictures. So it's a camera, it's a flashlight, and it's our texting system.
It's Radio Shack's back room from the 1990s.
It is. Yeah. It is indeed. Yes. And so phone is the last descriptor we ought to use. So he is calling it the flashlight or the rectangle. But more importantly, it has eliminated the barriers to entry in engaging with other members of a community with no intellectual commitment to what that is. You see something on social media that looks interesting, you can engage without having to put your brain through the process of deciding whether that's something you want to commit to or not. I call it the cool factor. Ooh, it's something fun and cool. And so you end up with NYU students being interviewed and being asked, so why are you out here protesting? Because we thought, why are we here protesting? Those are the kinds of commentaries you get. And so without any barriers to entry, we now have people engaging in communities that are centered around being together with no obligation to have an intellectual commitment to it. And as you're now seeing by many of these students, oh, I didn't realize this was going to get me into trouble, that it was going to cause me a problem with my degree, and that I wasn't going to be able to move on from here and get the great job I want to get and live the life my parents want me to live and be privileged. I now have to bear the burdens of my choices.
Lewis,
this falls right into the luxury belief mindset, where the typical manifestation of that concept is the privileged, overproduced elites espousing beliefs that then don't harm them immediately, but imposed consequences on the lower orders.
And in this case, lower orders are those lower orders of thinking where they don't process the actual consequences of the actions they take.
Lewis,
when we come back, might I ask you about the catalysts and the impetus for all this immediate and urgent protesting on behalf of this one conflict? Because it's interesting. The world is full of conflicts, and I've never seen anything like this with regard to, I don't know, Darfur or what's going on in West Africa. I wonder if you might speak to that when we come right back.
I'd love to.
Thanks. Lewis Hallman, Hugh Hallman. I'm Seth Leibson. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Lewis Hallman and Hugh Hallman are my guests. Lewis, the campus protests and riots that are taking place right now came together fast. They came together big, and they came together loud over this conflict between Israel and Gaza and the United States. And what's interesting to me is, and I've seen it in the coverage of Israel for decades, what is it about Israel that generates this kind of energy in a way that no other conflicts, or for that matter, if you want to argue displaced or stateless peoples, ever receive? It's an interesting exception in the world
of danger, isn't it?
You know, the why is something that I'm earnestly not sure. You know, but the fact is certainly well documented. You know, the longest hatred, as it has been described, the history of the Jews. You know, from the Egyptians in the Old Testament now through the centuries till today. You know, there's that notion that history rhymes. Certainly is brought to mind. But as far as the current protests, the current hullabaloo of about the conflict in Gaza, I think it is grossly misplaced. And I think it demonstrates that so much upset and wailing and gnashing of teeth is being directed towards Israel, demonstrates utter ignorance on behalf of the protesters.
Give
and
us an
that
example.
They don't care about human life. This would be the example. If you take the total casualty count from every conflict that Israel has been a party to since 1948, go to Wikipedia. I encourage you all, search this up yourselves and do it. Add up.
Dig out the footnotes.
Add up all of the highest estimate, not the medium, not the lowest estimate, the highest estimate of all of the deaths in every conflict, Palestinian and Israeli, both sides. If you add that up for the last 76 years, you get about 60,000 people.
Until now,
about 45,000 Arab Palestinians and the like, and about 15,000 Israelis.
Now add another
now,
for this conflict.
For this conflict, if you take uncritically, if you just take the 30,000 Palestinian death number that is given by the protesters, that would be 90,000 people. That is a lot. That is a shocking and appalling amount of death. And frankly, I think any moral person would wish and would hope that Israel uses the most judicious and careful restraint as possible. But they have a good track record of doing that, in my opinion. Do you know why I say that? Because if you look at the Syrian civil war, move north, a couple hundred miles, that conflict has been killing 60,000 people a year for the last decade. It is not about the number of lives. If we take the protesters' numbers, the last 6 months of conflict in Gaza just equal the tenor of the Syrian civil war, which has been going on again for 10 years.
So do the numbers. You've got 60,000 deaths a year on average in Syria.
So over 630,000 cumulatively over the last 11 years versus 90,000 deaths on all sides from every conflict. And there are a lot of them that Israel has been in since 1948.
So 76 years of battle. You have, and in the instance of Israel,
one year of Syria,
and right. That these protesters on all these college campuses are gnashing teeth and wailing about the deaths in Gaza, 30,000 of them, while the same number, 30,000 deaths, occurred in Syria during the same period of time,
right.
Tells you that this is your point. There's something very special about Israel for these people as a target.
Yeah,
there's that's what the real issue is.
At least a minimum, taking the most conservative number.
I would say we could look at the civil war in Myanmar. We could look at the civil war in Yemen. We could look at conflict in Nagorno-Karabakh. We could look at the Ukraine conflict. We could look at South Sudan, which has recently erupted
Sudan
in civil war.
Sudan is probably the best example.
We could look at Eritrea, which is about to erupt in civil war. I just learned
this last week. How about the Muslims that are behind?
I just learned this last week that the Nigerian army is massacring children, the children of Boko Haram, that when it goes through villages and clears them out, because the median age of the people in those areas is under 16.
Yeah.
And child soldiers are endemic to that conflict. And so the Nigerian army is increasingly taking the position that it can't take risks.
It is ugly.
There is so much brutality and horror in the world. And to find a relatively merciful, relatively benign regime and try and lay every horror and ill of the world at its feet is madness.
Yeah, I don't think you'd have. I don't think you'd have 6 months of waiting to end Hamas with any other country. I just don't. The reason that it has taken so long is because of that reticence. I believe.
Right.
I believe. Anyway, the Hallmans and I will be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Hugh Hallman and Lewis Hallman, my guests. Hugh, former mayor of Tempe, attorney, educator. Lewis, the head of Insight Analytics LLC. The only point I wanted to add to all of these grievances in the world, of which there are many, many much more dire, many much more, what's the word?
Worthy of protest?
Well, yeah, worthy of attention, worthy of concern. And the enormity of them is, I believe, pales in Israel and Gaza compared to everywhere else that students seem not to care about. China, let's take, for example, at least a million imprisoned for merely being Muslim. At least a million, that's the conservative estimate, where houses are plowed down and people are put into slavery and training camps, brain training camps, psychological camps,
gulags.
Re-education camps, gulags. Not a peep on the campuses. Now, I'm not here to say that we should be telling people what they can and cannot protest for or against, but it does seem to me odd that there is all this energy directed at the least of the problems with a country that acts in war probably more morally than most others, when all the others seem to get a free pass that no one seems to care about and just merely yawns.
There is a hungering, and I'm not sure why it is entirely, but there is a deep and profound hungering on certain elements of the left to tar the state of Israel with the Nazi brush, with the Nazi epithet. There is a weird, vile impulse to take the horror that the Jewish people endured in the Second World War, I think, and to take that horror, rub their faces in it, and to cry, "You see, you're just like us. You are not special." There is some awful, iconoclastic impulse.
There is.
There's an interesting insight. You just said, not like us. And is that really that it is driven by those who engaged in that horror as the means by which they then get a pass for their past bad acts? Could that actually be fundamentally underpinning that tendency?
Potentially.
It is interesting that when you look at the legacy here, the shoe is quite properly fitted on the other foot. When you look at what that native leadership of the Arabs in the area called Palestine was doing during World War II, they were the ones actually siding with Adolf Hitler.
There is one record that I know of after the Second World War, of a Nazi fleeing Europe and going back to his home country and being greeted in triumph. And it was in Egypt.
Yeah.
We have the radio broadcast where welcomed back was the lion of the Arabs and the hammer of the Jews is what he was welcomed back as.
Yes, and Haj Amin al-Husseini, who was the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, spent so much of World War II in Germany. There are pictures of he and Hitler, you know, sipping cups of tea and looking over how he could help push along what was known as the final solution, which meant killing all the Jews. They worked hand in glove, and I think that they're obviously probably either ignorant of, ashamed, or they justify that alliance. But it is interesting how they have pasted that name onto the Jews. Someone made the point that, you know, after World War II, after Auschwitz was discovered, the world was rightly sympathetic especially to those whose eyes were not aware and whose brains were not aware to what was going on in Nazi Germany. The world was quite sympathetic to Jews. The world shed tears, cried, and helped work with them to give them a state. But any time Jews seem to try to stop that from ever happening again, that's when the world turns on them. And I think that it's fair if you go to the State of Israel, see how easy that would be. If you were to get rid of the territories that are of constant discussion, West Bank, Judea, Samaria, and Gaza. Israel's 9 miles wide at its most vulnerable point. That's a run your dad and I could do on a weekend, on a day, in a couple hours. And I remember my last trip to Israel. I'll just never forget this. We went through the main Holocaust Museum. It's a dark tour through darkness.
Awful.
Yeah, it's an awful tour. It was mostly non-Jews on the tour, and I was walking out. And at the very end, as you leave, go back outside, an elderly couple was standing next to me, part of the tour, and the husband said to the wife, "Now I know why Israel has nuclear weapons." Shocking thought. God forbid they ever be used. But you get a sense when you have a country that's 9 miles wide and you can do that to a people, and there are people that still want to do that to them. You know, it's not that we're asking Israel to be given a wide berth in its defense. We're asking that Israel be given at least the same berth that all these other countries are given.
Well, I don't even think you have to go that far. Let's go to the accountability point, that you keep hoping that someday people will be held accountable for their positions, like these young people on this campus, these campuses, running around with masks on and hoodies, breaking things and insisting that Columbia and other universities divest with no understanding of the unintended consequences of that Lewis pointed out earlier. You've got that going on. But let me remind you, we had protesters during Vietnam whose only response to the fact that 10 million people died after the U.S. pulled out was, well, we couldn't have known that. And the answer is, you're lying. We did know that. We understood those kinds of consequences. We've seen it before. We saw it in Russia. We saw it in Nazi Germany. So that's a problem. And so I think about things like Occupy Wall Street. A bunch of very well-educated or undereducated, but gone to elite universities, parents with lots of money, hanging out on Wall Street, which then spread similarly like wildfire around the world. I actually went and saw Occupy Frankfurt on one of my trips in and out of the other places, and it was amusing to watch. I got there at 5 o'clock in the morning and watched all of the financial workers showing up at their offices at 6 o'clock, overseeing this encampment in the park immediately across the street from most of the financial houses, with all these kids having partied the night away. You could smell the reek of marijuana and everything else going on, and the excrement and everything that comes from that kind of behavior. As we talked, that Haight-Ashbury saw the resurgence of diseases that had not existed for decades in the Western world, at least. And you recognize that's the kind of stuff that's going on. And it harkens to this point that we now have these tools that allow these kinds of things to spring up quickly with no intellectual engagement and no consequences to them. And the lack of consequence is part of the problem. And I think through what should universities now be doing? Because if we do not impose consequences on people for this kind of behavior, we are going to get even more of it. And rewarding bad behavior, hearkening to our toolbox, rewarding bad behavior assures that you get more of it.
Yeah, let me throw that both to you on a very specific question, and we'll close the show with it. Were you the presidents of these universities, how would you handle the takeover of these centers? And I'll let you both answer that question when we come right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show, and thank you to Lewis and Hugh Hallman for their ever-recurring appearances on Tuesdays. Presidents feel like they're in this between a rock and a hard place. Skillet and Charybdis?
Yep, absolutely.
What would you do? Whoever wants to go first. Lewis, you're president of Columbia. What do you do? They've occupied illegally a building through an insurrection.
Great. I am going to add up the salaries of all of the professors that are there, and I'm going to add up the total amount of student aid given to both merit-based and need-based given to the students that are protesting. I'm going to total up all of that money, and I am going to say that if they would like me to divest from, you know, XYZ companies, I will do so, and that all of these funds will be used to cover those transaction costs. They're coming out of the budgets, and so we're regrettably firing about a dozen professors and cutting about maybe 150 scholarships. But in the name of global justice, our student body has spoken, and we want to be held to account by these brave people. And so next year, Columbia is going to cost $120,000 a semester, and our class sizes are down to 45 students per professor. But you guys got what you wanted.
You're asking the wrong question. The right question was at the beginning. You have to move the clock back a bit. And when universities over the last 5 or 6 years gave up their position as the arbiters of truth and the honest brokers for free speech and academic freedom, and it's really occurred over the last 30 years, they started losing their ability to enforce rules about those issues. That's the first problem. So 6 months ago, what should Columbia have done? It should have started demonstrating that through leadership that we will be objective determiners of this square, that the public square will be available to everyone, that public square will be safe, and anybody who violates those rules will be arrested and thrown off campus and no longer a student here. Anybody who's not a student who shows up there will be arrested for trespass. And that level of beginning changes the outcome. It is now very difficult to reverse this trend. It is the problem that parents face. The moment you reward that child for throwing a fit in the grocery store to get candy, and you buy them candy and give it to them, you have just now taught a scientist how to run the experiment more than once. And that's what we have now. We have educated scientists who have been given free, easy lives by their very wealthy parents, who have continued to operate exactly this way, and now they show up at campus. And universities are ill-prepared to manage those kinds of people. And academics are especially ill-prepared to become the presidents of universities and manage those institutions. They lack the political skill and the understanding about how to use soft power and very pointed hard power when necessary.
Hugh Holman, Lewis Holman, thank you. What a great hour, as always, with you too. Thank you, young David. Thank you, Miss Terry. On behalf of everyone, I am Seth Leibson. Until tomorrow, God bless you all, and
class dismissed.